journalist sound positively sensible. But he is why I had come all the way to Seattle. He is the way I drop this romantic nonsense and go back to simple self-loathing. Overall, he almost looks the historian part. Natty, with his sensible gray t-shirt under a slightly darker gray sweater from maybe Brooks Brothers. Black specs with a serious heavy frame. A stylistic nod to Kevin Costner as he appeared in JFK, perhaps, but not on the nose at all. Subtle, scholarly, well-kept. Except inside, there's something clearly wrong with him in the same way there's something clearly wrong with me, in the way there's something clearly wrong with all surfers. A madness in his eyes, alongside the markings of pterygium. He keeps smirking as the waiter keeps impatiently tapping his pen as I keep saying, And as I look from the menu to the waiter to him, I feel his smirk is even more pronounced than the last time we spent time together. A little different, a little more aggressive. What is it? What's different? And then it dawns on me. The New Yorker had just made him their talk of the town. The New Yorker. As in the creme of polite society's crop. Esteemed by the upwardly mobile liberal and downwardly unmovable conservative alike. A surf historian. The talk of the town. He was described thusly. Warshaw is the world's leading surfing scholar, the Linnaeus of the lineup. Over the years, he's assembled a research library in his home of hundreds of books, thousands of periodicals, and some 350 movies, and created a database, logged, indexed, searchable. And can you believe that? Can you even believe it? Amazing. The honor that kicked him over the line, I think, was being named the Oxford English Dictionary's official surf vocabulary consultant. Can you believe that, too? I almost can't. When I first read that sentence in The New Yorker, I read it as the Linus of the lineup, as opposed to the Linnaeus of the lineup, as in Charlie Brown's pal who always carried the blanket, as in Lucy's younger brother. And I wondered, what in the world Linus had to do with surf or with Matt Warshaw? Later, I looked up Linnaeus and discovered he was the Swede who came up with binomial nomenclature, the two-part Latin system that the world uses to categorize every living species, like Homo sapiens, Felis catus, etc. Matt Warshaw was supposed to be too good for this, bred to be too good for this. His lineage was built out of famous scholars and proper, culturally verifiable intelligence. Grandfather, a PhD from the Sorbonne. Mother, a PhD from UCLA. Father, a mathematics genius and physicist at Rand Corporation, with brothers and uncles, and maybe another grandfather, successful personalities at the University of Chicago and Columbia. Most of the family found their way to California, though, as intelligent people do, and set up shop. My family had all this cool L.A. shit, he tells me after I decide on a Contiki, sending the waiter away with a look of bewildered semi-annoyance. All this smart, liberal, cool L.A. shit they were doing, all of which I was completely ignorant of, because when I started surfing at age 8, I didn't give a shit. None of it meant anything to me. I didn't care about any of it. It's all this stuff that I find out way, way, way later, how cool my family is. But at the time, I was just out blithely surfing and not paying attention. I was probably, looking back, expected to go to a good university, but I went to San Diego State, and you go to fucking San Diego State to surf and drink beer, and that's what I did for a year, and then I quit. That was too fucking rigorous for me, right? And I started working at a surf shop, and that's when my mom kicked me out of the house. Matt's genetic intelligence couldn't stay buried forever, and the strands of smart DNA had begun to twist around his surf addiction. He worked at that surf shop and parlayed that into a job writing for Surfer magazine, then became its editor-in-chief and was getting paid well and living the good life. But his intelligence began to revolt against the emptiness, the shallowness, the pointlessness, the where do I put my hands in the water. So he quit and enrolled at UC Berkeley and proceeded to get his history degree before going to UCLA to get his PhD in history. And then the revolt of his intelligence was beat back by the powerful forces that lurk in the shallow end, so he dropped out again to chase the surf life, to become, as the New Yorker put it better than I ever could have, the Linnaeus of the lineup, a surf historian, the world's first and only surf historian. He has written the 200,000-word Encyclopedia of Surfing and the equally lengthy History of Surfing. He has a scholar's mind and a surfer's hollowness. And I need to ask him an important question right now, a question so important that it necessitated a trip up to Seattle, a question that my future hinges upon. The waiter sets down my Contiki with needless aggression, still upset, I think, that I didn't take his very sensible suggestion and veered so off course into the realm of rum plus scotch plus Cointreau. I take a sip and marvel how good they mingle. Look at Matt and say, "Surfing didn't really begin in Hawaii, did it?" Matt scrunches his nose slightly while adjusting his appropriately toned-down Kevin Costner JFK specs. "It didn't begin in Tahiti, either," I continue. "It didn't begin anywhere in the gorgeous tropical Pacific, with its sheer beauty being such that it could, in theory and over time, render vision superfluous. Did it?" And I'm not asking did it. I'm saying did it because I want Matt to laugh at me. I want him to prove me wrong, to look at me like I'm a total idiot. I want that more than anything. But I know, in the deepest part of my heart, by the look on his face, that I'm right. That I am fucking right. The Norwegian, Thor Heyerdahl, you see, came up with a seemingly wild hypothesis in the early 1940s. He believed that it was a pre-Incan race from Peru that first populated Polynesia, that they had somehow sailed thousands of miles across the Pacific and set up camp, that Polynesians were Peruvians a few thousand years removed. The scholarship of the time was conclusive. Polynesia was first settled from China downward and westward, and it was absurd to believe anything else. But Thor was a romantic and had heard an Incan legend that suggested that a white-skinned people once lived in Peru and were ruled by the sun god named Contiki. They built magnificent stone structures and were very modern, but, as happens, were attacked by a group of bearded white-skinned people and brutally massacred. Ask anyone who lives in Brooklyn or Venice Beach about this regularly occurring phenomenon. Contiki managed to escape with some of his closest friends. They made it to the shore, which was ugly, cold, perpetually shrouded in cold mist, then pushed out to sea and were never seen again. When the Spaniards first came to Peru, Heyerdahl unearthed notes suggesting that ruling Incans told their new guests that the magnificent deserted ruins were built before their time by white gods who had fled westward across the Pacific, never to return. The first European explorers to set foot on certain of the Pacific islands did, in fact, find that the natives there were shockingly white, some even having blonde hair. And while it all sounds very Mormonish, Heyerdahl believed that it was some Neolithic Peruvian people who were the first ever from Hawaii to New Zealand and all of Polynesia in between. He gathered linguistic, archaeological, and anthropological evidence that supported his claim. Polynesia has sweet potatoes, for example. Sweet potatoes that genetically come from Peru. Some DNA evidence gathered in 2011 even suggests a Polynesian-Peruvian link. Still, most scientists scoffed in large part because how in the world could the ancient Peruvians have sailed across the Pacific, all the way across the entire thing, in their primitive little rafts? Thor dug up any bit of information he could on Incan rafts by reading early Spanish accounts and studying archaeological evidence. In 1947, he and 5 brave Norwegian souls pushed off from Peru's shores on a balsa wood raft they had named Kon-Tiki. Some 101 days and 4,300 nautical miles later, they smashed into the Tuamotu Islands, Polynesia. Islands, coincidentally, with amazing surf. They filmed the entire adventure and won 1951's Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. More importantly, though, he proved that it was very possible for a trip of that magnitude to be made. But what was life like in ancient Peru? If it is true, if they were the first to settle Polynesia, what did they bring with them besides whiter skin and sweet potatoes? What were they doing besides building magnificent stone structures on that ugly shore? Oh, but they were surfing, of course. Surfing without palm trees, without blue water, without rainbows, without beauty, and probably in knit hats. Surfing since the very beginning of recorded time. Maybe since even 3000 BC. Getting their stoke on, thousands of years before any footprints, Mormon or other, scarred Polynesia's rose-colored sand. Surfing, just like they were in the International Surfing Museum's window. Archaeological interest in South America took a bit longer to establish than, say, Egypt or Greece. But when scientists started scratching the dirt, they discovered magnificent wonders like Machu Picchu, which was coincidentally stumbled upon by a Hawaiian with a Mormonish name, Hiram Bingham III. And El Paraiso, which had been a booming coastal metropolis in 4000 BC. And Guerrero Cave, which had been a Peruvian party spot since 10,000 BC. And Corral, with magnificent pyramids older than the ones in Egypt. They discovered drawings of little horses, too, or caballitos. The caballito was not a flesh-and-blood actual little horse, but rather a boat made up of a bundle of reeds maybe 6 feet long, squared at one end and flipped up on its other, like an extra chubby surfboard. Peru's fishermen have been using the caballito since at least 3000 BC to fish, move goods between coastal villages, and surf, and to surf at least 1,000 years before the Polynesians. To be fair, their surfing consisted mostly of cruising the shore break to the beach after a day's fishing or moving goods, but there are ancient ceramic sculptures of Peruvians perched on caballitos, heads down with broad, empty smiles stretching from ear to ear, clearly surfing. And did these pre-Peruvian fishermen bring surfing with them when they set off across the mighty Pacific thousands of years ago? Is this the heart of surfing? And if an ugly, cold coast is the heart of surfing, then where did eye scales come from? Matt is not laughing at me. He's trying to control his smirk as he rolls up one sleeve of his sensible sweater, takes a sip of his Sauvignon Blanc and says, No, it's just fishermen coming in from a day's catch and laying their paddles down to ride a wave in and thinking, oh, that feels kind of good. It's like if you had to ride your bike home from work every day and the last 200 yards of your ride is downhill to your driveway. That's awesome. I'm done with my job now. Just let me put my feet up on my handlebars and ride down the hill. I guess surfing needs to be something more, or at least it does to me by definition. It needs to be its own thing. You're designing a craft for surfing, and you're going out in the water to surf. That's where I would draw the distinction. And if you're talking about where we come from, obsessing about surfing and standing up on waves on boards, my gut tells me there's no other way that it makes sense except for it having come from Hawaii. But I see that his heart is not in his explanation as I take another sip of my Kon-Tiki. And this is why I had to come to Seattle instead of just calling him up on the phone. I had to see his reaction with my own eyes, and now that I have, I know that Matt Warshaw, the Linnaeus of the lineup, a surf historian, Surfing's only historian, is wrong. I can feel that he's wrong. His eyes are betraying him. Damned Tragedium. He's the first to admit that surf history is an oral game, told and retold and eventually turned into myth. He even once wrote, "Demythologizing the sport, in fact, was another great goal of mine. I couldn't wait to sledge away at the cheerleading and boosterism and perjured nobility layered onto most of the surf history. Pulling down shoddy historiographic handicraft is, by itself, I admit, pretty satisfying. But the real purpose, and the real pleasure, comes from the fact that the mortal, ground-level version of events is, almost without exception, more compelling than the legend or the myth." Now I smirk for the first time since seeing that damned Peruvian poster. I take another sip and chuckle inside, except even more bitterly. Look at the surf historian listening to his gut over the facts. God bless him for still being a surfer above all else. A surfer so addicted that he had to move to Seattle, Washington, in order to remove the temptation and raise a son. But he is wrong. Part of me, though, wishes I could listen to my gut, too, that I could kick Thor Heyerdahl and his merry men from my heart forever, because a menace lies in his story. Kon-Tiki was remade as a feature film in 2012, starring Gustav Skarsgård, who plays Floki on the History Channel's brilliant Vikings. He's the crazy one with the amazing eyeshadow, but not the dreamiest of dreamies, which is Ragnar Lodbrok, played by Australia's Travis Fimmel, with his braided hair and his perfect nose and his bluest eyes. A man so handsome that I sometimes fear my wife will leave me for him. I wish I could listen to my gut, like Matt, and flush horrible new plans away. But I can't, because I already know. Riding a wave is surfing. It is a simple scientific definition, the most pure essence. Intention has nothing to do with it. And yes, Polynesia is gorgeous. It is so gorgeous that any stumbling shallowness grown there can be forgiven. Peru's coast, again, is not beautiful. It is not beautiful by any definition, either scientific or romantic. Ugly, cold, perpetually shrouded in cold mist. And so, if it was not beauty that stole the surfer's eye, then what was it? I will tell you. It was cocaine. And the world's most endearingly degenerate love story just turned into its oldest. And I am the one destined to write it. And if I write it right, it will make surfing great again, because surfers everywhere will have to admit exactly what they are. That they're not soulful dancers or athletes or sportsmen or watermen. They are addicts. We are addicts. And if we can all admit that we are addicts, then surfing can shrug off the thing that's holding it down. It can shrug off the staid conservatism from the Disney and NFL executive vision, and free itself from the apocalypse. I can't sit here listening to this Seattle atheist any longer. I can't run like Jonah in the Bible. It is time to accept my fate. I am a surf journalist. Chapter 4. Road of Trials and Tests. I fly back to San Diego, smashed in a middle seat between a chunky Denver Broncos superfan reading Unfiltered, the collected thoughts of that old Duck Dynasty patriarch, and a lesbian. Or I think she's a lesbian because she's listening to Indigo Girls so loudly that I can hear it, and pairing Doc Martens with denim shorts. The drink cart clinks down the aisle, waddled by a kind steward with an almost perfect mustache. I order two mini Tito's bottles and one can of soda and end up knocking into both Duck Dynasty and Indigo Girl while trying to pry my wallet from my still too tight jeans. Both glare slightly and edge away, leaving me with an armrest on each side. Since I forgot to bring a book and didn't have time to buy a magazine, I'm left to drink and ponder this sudden turn in my life, the journey I'm about to embark upon. And why has surfing and cocaine's ancient love story stayed relatively hidden for so many years? Why is now the time for it to be revealed to the world? Is it because we live in such painfully divisive times, with the left fighting the right and the poor fighting the rich and the healthy eating the sick? Could this love story, beyond freeing the surf industry from its nasty conservative shackles, bring us all together the way that Romeo and Juliet brought together the Montagues and Capulets? I look over at Duck Dynasty, who's fallen asleep, then at Indigo Girl, who's ripping into her Northwest Deli picnic pack. Can cocaine and surfing's bond against impossible odds unite even these two? The plane lands before I can engage either in conversation, a test of the love story's cathartic properties in our polarized era, though, in truth, I was probably overreaching. Surfing, and what happens in surfing, only matters to surfers. I switch my phone off airplane mode, and its broken screen fills with messages. You coming? Hey, bro, come. Wanna drive together? Come. I'm confused until I check my emails and see that tonight is the death party for surfing. Yesterday, after 53 years, the magazine had officially closed its doors, a victim of the general surf industry apocalypse, the reign of terror. Print is dying everywhere, and particularly in the surf industry, where the apocalypse guts budgets, but neither of those things actually killed surfing. Surfer killed it. The two are, or were, owned by the same group, and the gutless babies at Surfer always felt threatened, so they went crying to the publisher and wept, "Us or them." Since the publisher had just diversified its portfolio by turning Surfer into a chain of bars, it was a seemingly easy decision. I was a retained writer at Surfing a few years back, when retainers still existed, then the editor at Living Large for a few more years, a mostly pretend title that suited my mostly pretend contributions. I always brought the absolute worst ideas to the table, like dedicating an entire issue to the graphic designer's son because his name was Pablo and he had an amazing blonde afro, or rerunning issues from 10 years ago word for word and seeing if anyone noticed. My high watermark, probably, was going to Florida and sneaking into the 2012 Republican National Convention by promising some drunk Southern party boss the surf vote, then writing a story about Mitt Romney's mouth. And I'm about to respond, hell no, to the party invites. I am not sentimental and don't feel in the mood for empty surf chats, and would rather watch an episode of Vikings, damn that hunky Ragnar Lodbrok, but stop myself because I remember that I have a new journey, a new calling. And so I drive from San Diego to San Clemente. I call my wife as I pass Cardiff by the sea and explain that I have to go to a quick surf party. She sounds too understanding. She's probably going to watch that damn hunky Ragnar Lodbrok all by herself. But I can't let jealousies get in the way of my new journey, and I pull into the parking lot of Molly Bloom's Irish Bar 30 minutes later, a surf journalist. I don't know what exactly I'm looking for here, but I assume whatever it is will find me. Pushing through the door, I am once again enveloped in a scene that has played out the exact same for the past forever. A messy knot of people pushing toward the bar and toward the bathroom with equal force. Too close, too loud for talking. Too much talking. Nose rubbing. Chatty, conspiratorial. Ecstatic, depressed. Ecstatic, chatty, conspiratorial. It's always snowing in Orange County, or so they say. I try to press toward the bar, but am intercepted by a very dapper industry bro holding an extra vodka something. I take it from him, and he says, "Yeah, Chaz," while nodding slowly and flashing a half smile. In another world, his face would belong to a heartthrob singer, or an actor, or a model, or at the very least a teeth model. His teeth are impossibly straight and white. I would have assumed that they are veneers, but they are not. They are real, and blindingly white, and so straight. I can't take my eyes off of them, and probably look weird when I respond, "How's it?" while staring at his mouth. In another world, his very handsome face would be pinned to the bedroom walls of teenage girls and orthodontists. In this world, it does sales for the surf forecasting website Surfline, and before that, it was surf team manager for a surf shoe brand called Globe. And surf industry genetics are a thing to behold. Inside, it may seem the surf industry bro is a vacuum, an empty vessel, even though his heart is racing for his true and ancient love. Outside, though, he is almost perfect. Always lean, always tan, always well-proportioned, always salty, ideally tousled hair, though usually a little short. Why? The surf industry bro doesn't grow food or build things or know things. Why, then, has evolution gifted such a worthless cultural appendage with such genetic superiority? I don't really know, though think it has something to do with the surf industry's mecca being Orange County, a place that molds its population after itself, pretty and vapid. This particular surf industry bro, the one with the beyond handsome face and perfect teeth, and I chat empty surf talk for a minute. "You surf today? Sick. Where?" etc. And then he asks me what I'm working on next, after that Hawaii book. I tell him, "Cocaine plus surfing. It's a love story." His nod doesn't change rhythm, nor does his smile change intensity. And he says, "Yeah, well, you won't have any shortage of material," before pushing off into the sweaty pit. I watch, thinking about his teeth, and wondering what career avenues open for a man with perfect teeth. But those thoughts are interrupted by an angry mouth too close to my ear. "These fuckers. These fucking fuckers are taking surfing away from us. Fucking fuckers. They wanted us to fail so they could shift our image archive away and sell it for millions of dollars and fuck us out of our rights. Now they won't have to pay us, any of us, for reusing shots. Fucking... a damned surf photographer." I nod and say, "Yeah, totally," before shuffling back toward the bar. I want to leave already, but I'm really trying to honor my journey, trying to be a good surf journalist for the first time in my life, trying to uncover little specifics in the world's greatest love story, like asking people questions and stuff. I just got done asking Surfing's ex-editor-in-chief, Taylor Paul, if he likes cocaine. He looked at me all pucker-faced and said, "No, are you kidding me? I hate the stuff. It makes everyone so lame." I suppose he's the exception to the rule. After all, he's from Santa Cruz, and most Santa Cruz surfers love methamphetamine. I just got done asking an intern who works for the extreme sports sock company Stance if she has any cocaine. She said no while looking at me like I was a total idiot by subverting the social order. I was supposed to be telling her I had cocaine. Stance is one of the only companies thriving in the surf space, though, so I thought it was a fair question. I then ask a part-time professional surfer, part-time DJ, if he wants cocaine. He says, "Sure," then gets angry when I tell him I don't have any. And I really should have left an hour ago. It's too late, and now I'm depressed and caught in the conspiratorial web of another surf photographer who is even more furious than the last that Surfing Magazine got shut down and is insisting that the magazine was actually making money and doing well. The crowd is still thick and getting sloppy. It would be impossible to guess if his rant, or the rant before his, is cocaine-infused, because most surf photographers are, by nature, conspiratorial. Someone is always stealing their art. No one is ever paying them enough. Everyone in this whole damned industry has profited, and profited handsomely, except them. In their collective mind, they are getting fucked. Always getting fucked, and always ready to snap about it. Though I once carried a surf photographer's backpack across a mile of beach and instantly understood surf photographer rage. The backpack weighed 250 pounds. The sand was scorching hot. It was like a forced march, and all surf photographers should be paid reparations by the brands for their servitude. Fucking saw one of my shots being used by fucking Rip Curl on their Instagram feed. Gonna fucking kill someone. The surf photographer rage and victimization complex is extreme, but also mirrors the way most surfers feel about the surf industry. Surfers love surfing and reckon it such a pure love, such a rush, such a kick, such a high. But then they start looking around and seeing more and more people riding waves alongside them, and they turn into strange, possessive golems, hating other surfers, stealing their waves, getting high off their waves, fucking other surfers, and hating the industry that's built around selling their personal dream. So much like the last boy with a baggie of cocaine at a dying party. Such hiding in the bathroom. Such suspicion of everyone and everything. I run into a rep, or brand representative, who's old now and has slowly slid down the pole of relevant brands, from Rip Curl wetsuits to On a Mission surfboard bags, and is now shilling wax and skateboards. He should know better. He should have gotten out forever ago, but this whole damn surf thing is a trap. And he asks me, "You seen Dill Dog? Somebody said that bro was here, but I swear he Christian bailed an hour ago. How's that? I told him this party was going to be on like Donkey Kong." He starts to trail off, but is also an autodidact, so I ask him, "What is the history of cocaine?" He rubs his nose and says, "Started in 3K BC, broski." I say, "Cool." Then quickly Google cocaine, while he starts to behave inappropriately in front of a waitress, and see that he is right. Coca has been a part of South America since at least 3000 BC, pretty much the same day as surfing. The tree, short and stubby with fiery red berries and electric green leaves, grew natively at the base of the majestic Andes, in what we now call Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and Colombia, and has been a continuous part of coastal ancient life throughout the northern part of the continent for literally ever. Depictions, or actual carbon traces of coca, are found in art, mummies, sculpture, ceramic pots, and little satchels. There is no definitive scientific theory about how it got there, but Amerigo Vespucci, the Italian explorer for whom the whole land is named, both north and south, spotted it straight away on his first visit in 1499, and wrote, "We descried an island that lay about 15 leagues from the coast and decided to go there to see if it was inhabited. We found there the most bestial and ugly people we had ever seen, very ugly of face and expression, and all of them had their cheeks full of a green herb that they chewed constantly like beasts, so they could barely speak. Each one carried around his neck two gourds, one of them full of that herb, and the other of a white powder that looked like pulverized plaster. They dipped a stick into the powder, and then put the stick in the mouth, in order to apply powder to the herb that they chewed. They did this frequently. We were amazed at this, and could not understand its secret or why they did it. At least since 3000 BC, these pre-Incans, these Valdivians, had been toying with their dopamine levels. They had been using the coca leaf for all manner of reasons, both mundane and sacred. It's even suggested that it was the very first plant to be cultivated in the Americas. These earliest men would use the leaf to stave off hunger, to keep altitude sickness at bay, to give energy, and to cure disease. Priests would use coca ritually to protect from curses, change bad luck, predict the future, and make offerings to Mother Earth, whom they called Pachamama. The Spanish, when they first began establishing colonies in this new world, for example, brought their Catholicism with them, and the Catholic priests did not like this coca-chewing ritual offered to Mother Earth, or any of its attachment to pagan gods. They thought it would be better if the plant were eradicated altogether, but understood its value in keeping the native population working. Local traditions had it that buying and selling coca was blasphemy, frowned upon by the gods, but the Spanish overrode that with the church's blessing. They did not care what the lowercase g gods wanted, and so they seeded the world's first large-scale coca plantations, paid the natives in coca, and became the new world's first proper drug dealers. A Spanish contemporary is noted saying in Colombian professor Jorge Bejarano's New Chapters on Cocainism, "Our fair-minded masters do not want the poor to recognize their tragedy and wish instead that they should die without realizing their hunger and their ignorance, that the bitter taste of coca might dull the instinct to rebel, and that they might live in an artificial paradise." The chewers, thus, didn't need as much food and were kept warm and altitude sickness-free and docile and happy, even a million feet underground and very close to hell. They were mining silver and gold, digging deep into that Mother Earth, sending the riches across the seas to masters they had never met nor heard of. They worked torturous hours with wives and children starving outside, but with relaxed faces and relaxed spirits. Relaxed faces and relaxed spirits. Surfing and cocaine have truly come to look like each other, in the same way that a long-time dog owner will begin to resemble his mutt, and maybe because they were together in Peru, mingling for 3,000, 4,000 years, before anyone even peeked in on them, dancing some early, partially forgotten dance, belonging to each other from the very beginning. There's an ancient creation story about coca, that the tree was once the most beautiful woman on earth, so gorgeous that all the wave-riding fishermen fought over her. Since not everyone could have her, the elders turned her into a plant so she could be enjoyed by everyone equally. But then, like in any great love epic, the two were split, torn apart by forces out of their control. Surfing went to Polynesia. It was embraced by the Tahitians, then really embraced by the Hawaiians. It was changed and reordered and reset and remade. And coca went to Europe. Those early Spanish settlers busily exported new and fascinating plants they discovered back home. Coffee and its future Starbucks. Tobacco and its Marlboro Red. Chocolate and its Hershey's. The old world fell in love with these fabulous products and the magic properties they contained, but somehow the most magical of these stayed behind. It's been hypothesized that coca chewers looked like cows munching cud, and the aesthetic turnoff was great enough for conquistadors to find no real interest in it outside of suppressing the native masses. Whatever the reason, the coca bush was left alone until 1855. But then, the world cracked. Scientists had begun to isolate compounds in plants, pulling them out and allowing them to pop in full. Morphine in 1804, caffeine in 1819, codeine in 1832, cocaine in 1855. The German chemist Friedrich Gadke isolated the specific cocaine alkaloid and published his findings in a journal read by another German chemist, Friedrich Wöhler, who in turn asked a colleague on an Austrian boat traveling around the world to bring him loads of coca leaves. The colleague agreed, and Wöhler passed the leaves on to his German chemist friend, Albert Niemann, who then fixed the purification process and wrote his University of Göttingen dissertation titled Über eine neue organische Base in den Coca-Blättern, or On a New Organic Base in the Coca Leaves, which he published in 1860. Dr. Niemann's first description of this newly isolated and purified alkaloid was less than poetic. He simply wrote, "Its solutions have an alkaline reaction, a bitter taste, promote the flow of saliva, and leave a peculiar numbness, followed by a sense of cold when applied to the tongue." He named his alkaloid cocaine, borrowing coca from South America and in from the stylistic way of describing local anesthetics of the day. Coca-in. Cocaine. And it all seems very cleanly scientific, no? Very modern man extrapolating into the future. Except the isolation of cocaine from the coca plant did something far greater. Tom Feiling, a Colombian hip-hop documentarian and cocaine scholar, wrote, "This isolation was not only a chemical process, it also sheared psychoactive substances from their specific cultural context. They could now be packaged as commodities and sold to anyone with the money to buy them. Since these substances were no longer dispensed by healers or reserved for special ceremonies, people had to learn how to take drugs all over again. And there went cocaine from Peru to Europe, getting isolated and purified and freed from its cow-like cultural context. And there went surfing from Peru to Polynesia, standing up and getting nude and becoming a full wild obsession. Like the Princess Bride, remember? The very pretty farm girl, Buttercup, played by the gorgeous Robin Wright pre-Penn, and the handsome stable boy, Wesley, played by the dashing Cary Elwes, fell into love as poverty-stricken youth. Semi-weird, not sexy in the farm, barn context. Cow shit and fetching water from the well and feeding goats and collecting eggs and discordant power situation, etc. Circumstances took them away from each other, though, and while they seemed rough at the time, Buttercup was made a radiant princess and Wesley a pirate, wearing the best black blindfold that has maybe ever been worn, or at least the best one that has been worn by someone other than John Galliano. They both turned gorgeous. And what if Buttercup and Wesley had never been separated? I'll tell you what, they would have gotten married and had kids, voted for populist candidates, eaten hot dogs, and lived on the farm, surrounded by cow shit and goats and chickens. Their children would have fetched water from the well and eggs from the chickens and would have fed those goats. But no, that's not a real love story. A real love story transcends. Buttercup and Wesley both transcended and were able to overcome the fire swamp, Prince Humperdinck, Andre the Giant, a priest with a speech impediment, and death in order to swing from the most glorious heights. Surfing and cocaine needed to be separated from each other to find their best selves, or at least their truest selves. But nothing can keep true loves away, and the very alluring, albeit dull, cocaine, the very obsessed surfing, were sure to reconnect. The social media manager for a different surf magazine that's trying to follow surfing into the grave bumbles past all sweaty and hot. I ask him if he loves cocaine. He turns toward me, his face becoming a menacing scowl, and he says, "You better not write anything about me, Chaz. You better not, you fucking dick. Everyone hates you." Before storming off. I guess he does. Chapter 5. Belly of the Whale. I drive home from Surfing Magazine's wake, maybe drunk. But isn't that the way you're supposed to come home from a wake at an Irish bar and an open casket funeral? I've watched Snatch enough to know. Wait, was Brad Pitt Irish in Snatch? He was, wasn't he? I can't remember. Irish or maybe Welsh? The next few weeks, in any case, morph back into my standard pre-divine appointment surf journalist grind. I pen instant classics, such as Surfers Who Should Have Died at 27 and Hot, World's First Trans Surfer. while trying to grasp a receding narrative of surfing and her cocaine. The world's first trans surfer story was actually interesting. An Australian surf champ from the 1970s named Peter Druin decided to transition to Westerly Wendina a few years ago. He changed clothes, fingernail polish, dress, hair, and became very beautiful, a blonde bombshell. Then it was time for the final change, but after hemming and hawing for a while, decided that he wanted to be Peter Druin again and came out as his old self at a Gold Coast Surf Awards show. The great Jamie Brissick wrote a book about this adventure titled Finding Westerly. And like Peter Druin almost lost his thread, I'm almost losing mine. What happened to cocaine and surfing after they got separated? Where did they go? I can't really concentrate because right now, a loud man from Ohio is smashing into me at Duke's Barefoot Bar in Huntington Beach, telling his wife that there was a shark sighting near the pier last week, but that he learned on Shark Week that great white shark attacks on humans are actually down this year overall, but hell with it anyway. Gonna rent a board tomorrow and give it a whirl. I came to Huntington to meet with a surf filmmaker that I was supposed to do a story on, but he blew me off, and I was sitting on the pier with no date and decided to be an asshole and go to Duke's. I don't actually know if the man sitting next to me is from Ohio either, but he is wearing a bright red Ohio Buckeyes cap and also a brand new Billabong t-shirt, which he is pronouncing Billabonic. I wonder if they got Billabonic boards down there at the beach rental place. His wife gives a passive shrug and takes a sip of her Mai Tai. She's wearing a brand new t-shirt that reads, Huntington Beach, California, Surf City, USA. I take a sip of my Mai Tai also and smile. This sort of surf mockery, this utter kookiness, used to annoy me badly because in my deepest heart I knew it was not too far off from my own cold Oregonian root. I used to guffaw, point and laugh, mock. I used to make fun of the man who strapped a surfboard to the car fins down in an effort to cook the Barney from my own soul. But at some point, I realized it is there forever, no matter how much fun I make of others. I'm a surf journalist sitting at the Barefoot Bar in Duke's Huntington Beach next to corn-fed yokels drinking instead of interviewing a surf filmmaker. And it's a wonder someone actually made a modern Hawaiian surf-themed restaurant chain. There's the original Duke's in Waikiki, one in Malibu, one in La Jolla, and here in Huntington Beach. Very bad taste, and I don't mean decor. I'm a massive fan of tiki kitsch and faux koa wood, but Hawaiian food, that's what surprises me. That someone made a chain of uppish-scale restaurants that serves Hawaiian cuisine. Duke's doesn't actually serve real Hawaiian cuisine, I suppose. Real Hawaiian cuisine is spam musubi, a thick slice of marinated spam laid on a ball of sushi rice and tied down with some seaweed. And macaroni salad with extra Miracle Whip. And heaping balls of totally flavorless white rice. The restaurant is named after Duke Kawanamoku. He had a very fine bone structure, an enviable head of hair, an Olympic gold medal, a bevy of Hollywood starlets, and is credited with re-gifting surfing to the world. Surfing had gone to Polynesia and flowered mostly in Hawaii, but then the white man came. First Captain Cook in 1779, who watched the Hawaiians dance upon the waves. They killed him by smashing the back of his head in for disrespecting their island. But white men are a virus, and soon more came, and more, and more. They brought a nasty work ethic, exotic diseases, and a Calvinist outlook that judged surfing to be a gross pastime. And so it was discouraged, along with other quintessentially Hawaiian things, and the native population went into severe decline, dying from disease, being worked to death, being completely displaced by modern savagery. The tide began to turn slightly at the turn of the century. America's wealthy had discovered Hawaii as the perfect vacation spot and were soon steaming across the Pacific to newly built hotels on Waikiki's almost perfect sand. And these tourists fell in love with Hawaiiana. Coconut drinks, frangipani necklaces, hula, surfing. Duke Kawanamoku was born a pure-blooded Hawaiian in 1890 and came of age during this slow shift from Hawaii being a sort of indentured servant Calvinist hell to a coconut-scented paradise. A high school dropout and one of five brothers, he would spend his days playing on the beach, swimming, and surfing. Most of the Hawaiians at the time would ride shorter boards in the smaller waves nearer shore. Kawanamoku fashioned himself a traditional olo, what the Hawaiian royalty once rode, and caught bigger waves far out to sea. As he approached shore, he would twirl around or stand on his head, and the mainland tourists would thrill at this display. It was such a wonderful novelty to behold, such strange fun for visitors to watch. But there was no real place for surfing in society. And so it was swimming that first made Duke Kawanamoku famous. He broke the American records in the 50 and 100-yard distances and won a gold medal at the 1912 Summer Olympics in Stockholm. After achieving renown, Duke went on a publicity run to America's East Coast and brought surfing with him, wowing the large crowds that gathered, before ending up in sunny Southern California. By the 1920s, the worm had officially turned, and surfing had been reborn in 20th century America. I don't really know why those very early tourists who came to Hawaii didn't want to try surfing for themselves as they sat on the Royal Hawaiian's shaded veranda, sipping Mai Tais, eating whatever it was that people ate there before Spam, and watching those beach boys ride Waikiki like they do today. I don't know why it had to travel across the sea to colder water and worse waves to fully become a poison. But there they sat, sipping, eating, and passively watching, with one notable exception. The great Samuel Langhorne Clemens, better known as Mark Twain, wrote of his 1872 experience. In one place, we came upon a large company of naked natives of both sexes and all ages, amusing themselves with the national pastime of surf bathing. Each heathen would paddle 300 or 400 yards out to sea, taking a short board with him, then face the shore and wait for a particularly prodigious billow to come along. At the right moment, he would fling his board upon its foamy crest and himself upon the board, and here he would come whizzing by like a bombshell. It did not seem that a lightning express train could shoot along at a more hair-lifting speed. I tried surf bathing once, subsequently, but made a failure of it. I got the board placed right, and at the right moment, too, but missed the connection myself. The board struck the shore in 3/4 of a second without any cargo, and I struck the bottom at the same time, with a couple of barrels of water in me. None but the natives ever master the art of surf bathing thoroughly. Maybe it is strange that an elderly man sporting a wild, bushy mustache and spotless white suit would be the one to jump off the shaded veranda and into the sea. Maybe it doesn't fit a traditional narrative, but traditional narratives fall away when romance is introduced, and Mark Twain's surf froth makes perfect sense in this light, because the great American novelist had a surf-esque life plan before writing The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and so on. He surfed, yes, but was also thinking about becoming a cocaine baron. In a 1910 essay, The Turning Point of My Life, he wrote about a strange traveler he'd met. Also, he told an astonishing tale about coca, a vegetable product of miraculous powers, asserting that it was so nourishing and so strength-giving that the native of the mountains of the Madeira region would tramp uphill and down all day on a pinch of powdered coca and require no other sustenance. I was fired with a longing to ascend the Amazon, also with a longing to open up a trade in coca with all the world. During months I dreamed that dream and tried to contrive ways to get to Para and spring that splendid enterprise upon an unsuspecting planet, but all in vain. A person may plan as much as he wants to, but nothing of consequence is likely to come of it until the magician Circumstance steps in and takes the matter off his hands. At last, Circumstance came to my help. It was in this way. Circumstance, to help or hurt another man, made him lose a $50 bill in the street, and to help or hurt me, made me find it. I advertised the find and left for the Amazon the same day. This was another turning point, another link. Could Circumstance have ordered another dweller in that town to go to the Amazon and open up a world trade in coca on a $50 basis and been obeyed? No, I was the only one. There were other fools there, shoals and shoals of them, but they were not of my kind. I was the only one of my kind. Except that he wasn't the only one of his kind. He was part of a proud and ancient line of surfing coca-eaters that stretched away from him into a murky past and away from him into an equally murky future. Look at that Billabonic guy getting covered by the wave. What do they call it? Barrel? Look at him, Barrel. The Buckeye is nudging his wife and pointing toward a television hung near a fake thatched roof. She gives a passive nod and takes a sip of her Mai Tai. A replay of the Pipeline Pro Surf Contest is being shown, and the surfer doing Barrel is not actually a Billabonic guy, but North Shore standout Jamie O'Brien, who's sponsored by Red Bull and Body Glove. He is wearing a Billabong singlet, though, like everyone else in the contest, because the event's title sponsor is Billabong, the same Billabong that just released an Andy Warhol collection. I once came into Duke's with Jamie's amazing filmer, a friendly boy with the warmest smile named Big Island Damo. He had grown up on Hawaii's Big Island and never left until traveling to Oahu as an 18-year-old to film Jamie. And the first time he'd ever left the islands was when he came here to Huntington Beach. Big Island Damo had a wonderful lisp and the excitement of a child. Everything he saw was more spectacular than his mind could hold. Trains, giant freeways, people actually moving faster than molasses. The contiguous 48 were a wonderland, a kingdom of endless fascination. When he first went to the beach in Huntington, he was shocked at how many haoles lay on the sand, haole being the sometimes cute Hawaiian pejorative for white people. "Bah!" Big Island Damo exclaimed. "There's haoles everywhere." When a Primo beer truck passed us, he almost lost his mind. "Bruh, there's a king on the truck." Primo is Hawaii's beer and uses an image of King Kamehameha for their advertising. He was thrilled that Huntington had its own Duke's, but when we went to the Barefoot Bar, he was politely asked to please put shoes on. I think in that moment, the wonder of America fell away, conceding to a resounding confusion most Hawaiians feel from birth. I pull out my phone and think about writing a story on how Surfer Magazine has just stolen Surfing Magazine's Instagram account and turned it into @SurferFilms in clear violation of ethics instead. When drinking, I think all my ideas are amazing and funny, like the ones I used to bring to Surfing Magazine. Like Mitt Romney's hair. I'll text them to my best Australian pal and biz partner, and he'll post them. In the cold light of sobriety, they are always awful, filled with malaprops and misspellings. But I've had two Mai Tais already, so dive right into it. Lame. Surfer mag steal shit. Buckeye's wife has finished her Mai Tai and just ordered a Diet Coke and vodka. And I don't know that I've ever heard a grosser combination. I suppose it makes sense, though, in a restaurant featuring the culinary instincts of a culture that combined sushi and spam. Buckeye doesn't notice. He's staring at the TV, mesmerized, watching newly minted world champ John Florence snag an even deeper tube than Jamie O'Brien, I tell you, he says to no one, I've never seen more barrel. These Billabonic guys can really surf. John John is sponsored by Hurley and Vans. I watch the bartender fumbling with a can of Diet Coke while watching John John's strange smile.